Good evening. Our reading comes from Romans 8, verse 28 to 30, and it's on page 1031 of the Church Bibles. 31. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified.
So you'll do well to have that passage open and available as I speak from that. My name's Glenn, so it's good to meet you. It's interesting, isn't it? Did this week feel meaningful to you? Did you feel like you achieved something? Did you share warmth and relationships, relationship with someone? Did it feel meaningful to you? I've seen a couple of nods, so that's good. That's good. It did feel meaningful. It's amazing, isn't it? Most relationships give meaning to life. Our work gives meaning to our life. The kind of things we love give meaning to our life. Maybe music, maybe a sport. If you've got children, school, all sorts of things create meaning. Here's the interesting thing, though. Philosophically, lots of people really struggle with whether or not there is meaning in the universe. There's two reasons, or there's a few reasons, but here's two. One has got to do with our insignificance, our physical insignificance in the world. Alice, if you could show the first picture. This is a picture of the Earth from the Moon, taken of the Earth from the Moon by NASA. It's a photo by NASA. Here's a picture of the Earth from Mars. Here's a picture of the Earth from Saturn. And here is a picture of the Earth from Neptune. Do you feel just a little bit tiny? Now, that's within our solar systems. Our solar system, singular, I should say. And there are hundreds of solar systems. There's 100, if I get the number right, forgive me if you're an astronomer and I get it wrong, they think there's something like 100 billion galaxies. So when people step back and think about that, and they think about how astonishingly huge the universe is, and you are just a speck on the Earth, and you and I are less than a speck in the universe, the conclusion people come to is that humanity are insignificant. Our sheer size makes us meaningless, pointless. I mean, nothing you do affects the rest of the universe, does it? Face it. If all of humanity lined up on the planet and blew in one direction, we wouldn't even shift the spin of the Earth. Here's another picture just to kind of drive that home. The first one is a picture of the Earth compared to the Sun. So you can see that's the Earth down there. They've just kind of proportioned it. That's the Earth, the little blue dot, compared to the Sun. Now here is a picture of the Sun from Mars. We are astonishingly tiny. Do we have any significance? Do we have any purpose? Do we have any meaning in a universe that's so relentlessly large? Thanks, Alistair. Let me give you another image, perhaps one that's slightly more negative. One scientist, Carl Sagan, a bit of a popular scientist, says, based on the chemical composition of our bodies, all the stuff in your bodies is worth about a total of $3 worth of chemicals. That's it. That's the sum total of what it means to be human. If someone ground you up and separated all the chemicals, they could get about $3 for you, which is about the same as a Magnum ice block. In fact, Magnum ice blocks, I think, are $3.50. They're more expensive than you. They are worth more than the chemicals in your body. But here's the thing, isn't it? Life feels like it has meaning, doesn't it? Relationships feel meaningful. Decisions feel meaningful. Our loves and hates feel meaningful. The death of the people in Nice, that feels meaningful, doesn't it? That's why it's on the news. It is filled with tragic, tragic meaning. If there was no meaning there, we would just go, why is that on the news? Just show some more entertainment. It's interesting, isn't it? What do we do with this? See, if we have this meaning, you have to kind of decide, is this sense of meaning actually a massive lie? A huge disconnect between reality and our mental state. We feel like we've got meaning, but there actually is no meaning because we're so insignificant, we're so tiny. And so there's this huge disconnect. And you know what they, and so we're, you know, whenever we think that there's meaning, that we're out of touch with reality. And you know what they call people who are out of touch with reality? Insane. So one option is we're all actually insane, especially you. That's one option. We feel like there's meaning, but there is no meaning, so we must, if we're out of touch with the reality, we must be just slightly bonkers. That's one option. The other option is that the reason we feel like there is meaning is because there actually is meaning. Because there actually is purpose and significance in our lives. And that is the argument with Christianity. So going with this assumption that you are all not and neither am I insane, let's follow that line of reasoning that there is meaning. Well, if there is meaning, what is that meaning? What on earth, especially given Earth is such a small dot, what on earth are we here for? What purpose or point should we have? Well, Christianity argues we've got I've got five major ideas about what Christianity thinks we're here for. Here they are. We are planned for God's pleasure. We were formed for God's family. We were created to be like Christ, Jesus Christ. We were shaped for serving God. And we were made for God's mission. I'm going to work through those five. We were planned for God's pleasure. We were formed for God's family. We were created to be like Christ. We were shaped for serving. We were made for God's mission. Romans chapter 8, you might like to turn open. Listen to this language. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. What then shall we say in response to this? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not, along with him, graciously give us all things? So we were planned for God's pleasure. See Romans 8:29. For those God foreknew, he also predestined, which means he chose, to be what? Conformed to the image or the likeness of his son, who is Jesus. What did the Father think of Jesus? He found incredible delight and joy in him. God said, at one point, God the Father said about Jesus, here is my servant in whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. On Friday night, I coach an under-6 soccer team, and one boy has a huge number of skills. He's really amazing. He was running down the field with a ball, and then he did an amazing move. He kind of spun around the opposition. I don't quite know how he did it. He's only 6. And his mum turned to me with this, she didn't expect it, she didn't know it was going to happen, with this look on her face of just sheer delight. Look what that boy can do, isn't that amazing? That's how God the Father felt about Jesus. Look at that. Look at my son. Look at that boy, as it were. Isn't he amazing? God the Father looked on Jesus with great pleasure. Now, what does this verse say? God has worked through Jesus so that we are to be like Jesus. We are to be made for God's pleasure just like Jesus was. Verse 29, for those God foreknew, he predestined to be what? Conformed. Made like, that's what it means. It means formed like, changed to be like, transformed to be like Jesus. What are we here for? We are here to give pleasure to God, just like Jesus did. That God might look on us and delight in us because we're becoming more and more like Jesus. I think that's an incredible idea. If you think about the scale of the universe, that the Almighty Creator of that universe would delight in us. That has meaning, doesn't it? That has significance. That the one who created the universe that we can hardly comprehend would be able to find delight in us as we are like Jesus. And God, it says here, is at work to bring that about. We were planned for God's pleasure. Do you see the planning language there? For those God foreknew, he predestined. That means in God's decision in eternity, he chose. God planned this before the creation of the universe that people might be for his pleasure. You can give pleasure and delight to the Creator. Hey, that's a wonderful, amazing, incredible idea. Here's a question. Are you? We were planned for God's pleasure. Next point. We were formed for God's family. Look at the verse there. It's that he might be conformed to the image of his Son, that he, Jesus, might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. We were formed for God's family. Jesus is to be the inheritor, the firstborn, the oldest brother of what? Brothers and sisters. It's family language, isn't it? We were formed for God's family. How did God do this? Well, he made us blood brothers with Jesus. When I was in primary school, my best mate was a guy called Scott. Scott lived 5 kilometres away from me. I grew up on a farm. He was my closest neighbour, which is 5 kilometres. Well, it was 2 kilometres, but that involved 3 barbed wire fences and probably some angry farm animals. So you had to go out of one property, down the stock route, and back in the other property. So it was about 5Ks, right? And, you know, you really didn't want to walk across the farm. Grumpy farm dads messing with their crops. You just didn't want to do that. We used to ride to each other's places on our push bikes. And then as we graduated to motorbikes, we used to, you know, hang out together. Well, Scott and I think it was about 4th class, we became blood brothers. We'd seen it on Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn show. So we both cut our hands with our pocket knives, not very deeply, and exchange blood. That's how close our friendship was. He was the youngest son of with a family with 4 older girls. You can see why I was close to him. We became blood brothers. See, they say blood is thicker than water. How is it that people might become brothers and sisters of Jesus? Well, Jesus gave up his blood for us. That's what the cross is about. That's what Easter is about. That Jesus died on the cross to make us blood brothers and sisters, to make us a new family. God has started a new family. We were formed. Now think about that. Formed to be a family. I think it has big implications. What would you do for your family? Are there any limits to what you would do for your family? Some people, yes, actually. There's a lot of limits. But really, there shouldn't be, should there? We know that blood is thicker than water. We know that the closest calling on our time and energy and our love ought to be our family. In the family, their problems are your problems. Their hopes and dreams are your hopes and dreams. That's what it means to be in a family. So there's no limit. Not only that, but in a family, everyone's different but vital, aren't they? To use another analogy the Bible picks up on, it's a body that has many parts, but each part is different. But each part is vital. We were formed to be a family. I can't do without you if you're in God's family, and you can't do without me. God has brought us together, the Bible says, because we need each other. We were formed to be blood family. It's a word to the Christians. Do you think of yourself as vital to other people? If not, you've misunderstood what God has called you to. You are vital to other people. Their growth in God's family depends on you. That's why God brought you into the family with them. And your growth depends on them. We are formed for a family, but we are formed for a family, not for ourselves. See the language there? That Jesus might be the firstborn of many brothers and sisters. It's actually that he, firstborn, is not just the sense of oldest. It's the one who will inherit. The one who's the greatest in the family. This family is on about him. Formed to be a family, but a family that honors Jesus. Some churches are on about family, but are completely disconnected from Jesus, the oldest brother. They're so introverted. They're all about what they can get out of it. But no, it's about what can we do for Jesus. And that takes us to the next point. We were planned for God's pleasure. We were formed to be God's family. We were created to be like Christ. Pick it up slightly earlier in Romans chapter 8. I've just lost the verse. And we know, in verse 28, that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. He might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. We are created to be like Christ, to be like Jesus. I don't know if that feels like a good thing to you. It depends, I think, on how familiar you are with the person of Jesus. If you've got that stereo picture of a white Anglo-Saxon male who carries a lamb and, you know, hippie hair and hippie clothing, then you think, well, I don't want to be like Jesus. He's from the 70s, man. But if you know the person of Jesus, if you've read about him in the eyewitness accounts and you see his love, his mercy, his power, his courage, that is such an exciting idea. Do you have significance? Yes. Could there be a greater significance? Not just that you were created to exist in this vast universe, but that you are created to be like Christ, the one who will rule the universe. That is an astounding idea. See, God's goal and the ways at work in your life and my life is to make us like Jesus in every area, in our heads, in our thinking, in our hearts, in our desires and motives and choices and wills, and with our hands, with the things that we do. So what does that mean? Look at verse 28. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. What is that good? To make us like Jesus. So when suffering and difficulty comes, it's not meaningless. It's not without point. This is saying God's at work in all things, including suffering and difficulty and hardship, to do what? To make us like Jesus. Now that, when you understand how great Jesus is, that ought to be appealing. That's wonderful. Suffering and difficulty and hardship is not pointless. It's pointed. It has a goal. When suffering and hardship and difficulty comes, though, how do you think about it? See, I think if we understand that that's the goal, that God's at work for our good, that's God's purpose, and it will be our good, it transforms it. You go, God, yes, shape me by this. Give me patience. Give me strength. Give me humility. Protect me from bitterness. Transform me. Suffering has meaning. But also the good times have meaning and purpose. They're not just endless hedonism that once they're over, that's it, they're gone. God's at work in all things for our good. What is God's purpose? In joy and satisfaction and entertainment. Actually, God's at work in that to make us like Jesus. When you enjoy things, does it cast your mind to the goodness of God? Because that's where Jesus constantly went in his thinking. He constantly went to the goodness and generosity and the provision of God. That's what God would have for us. God is at work in every area of our lives to be created like Jesus. Think of the areas of your life, family, extended family, those you love, those you endure, those you try not to hate. Another area of your life, money, from the coins that are hidden down the back of the couch to that mysterious money that you supposedly have in the superannuation account. From your health, from those small injuries that you got as a child that you've forgotten about, through to those life-changing illnesses that may have happened. From your skills and the gifts, from where you grew up, from the place you grew up, from the context in which you grew up. This passage is saying, you are not insignificant. But God is at work in all of that so that you might be like Jesus. It's a challenge for us. If you're a Christian, is that your goal? To be like Jesus. That's God's goal. Now, if you're not Christian, this is kind of crazy news. I get that. That's okay. Just come along for the ride. It's partly weird until you've met Jesus and understood him and seen how wonderful he is. But that's the thing. Even if you don't yet know Jesus, the Bible's saying that's God's purpose for your life. That he wants you to know Jesus and become like him. That's why God created you. That's why you have such significance in such a large and incredible universe. We are created to be made like Christ. And we are shaped for serving. That's the next point. We are shaped for serving. We know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, being called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. See, what was Jesus like? What gave him delight? Serving God the Father. That's what gave him delight. He came to do God's will, he said, again and again and again. Our lives are for serving God. Let me just talk about one implication for that. It's the reason that having stuff fails to satisfy us. Have you noticed that? That having stuff fails to satisfy us. Yep, for a little while when we get it, it's wonderful and it's life-changing and it's transforming for a little while. Here's what one guy said from a book called Affluenza. The arguments of data show that successfully pursuing materialistic goals fails to increase one's happiness. When people and nations make progress in materialistic ambitions, they experience a temporary improvement in mood, but it's likely to be short-lived and superficial. Why? Well, the reason is we weren't made for stuff. We were made for serving. That's why materialism doesn't work. We weren't made for stuff. We get to use it. We get to enjoy it. It's a good and great gift for God. But we weren't made for it. We were made to serve God. And the Bible's promise is that God gives us the desires of our heart. As we delight in him, as we find ourselves in serving him, as we find ourselves in seeking him, we do get that satisfaction, that contentment, that delight. Let me read to you from one of the Psalms of the Old Testament. It says, "Do not worry because those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like grass, they will soon wither. like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Hear that? Take delight in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him and he will do this. He will make your righteousness, which is your incredible goodness, a reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Now, we don't have time to go in that, but he's saying, as you commit yourself to God and seek to serve him first and foremost, God will give you delight. But then it reframes the delight to be a little bit like Jesus, where the things that delight you are about transformed character. But isn't that what we most want? Isn't that what we most want? Transformed character? That we want to be more loving? That we want to be more generous? That we want to be more patient? That we want to be kinder? We want to be more joyful when things are hard? That's what most of us, that's what we ultimately want. You know, we look to new houses and we look to new cars and we look to tech. But they don't change our heart. Can there be anything more meaningful than serving the creator of the universe? I'm hard-pressed to think of something. This idea is incredible that we were made to serve God. Can there be anything more significant and important that we could possibly do? Talk to me afterwards if you can think of it, because I can't. Finally, we were made for mission. We're on the downhill run, a couple of minutes to go. Hang in there. We were made for God's mission. When Jesus came, the whole argument has been that we've been changed, transformed by God's power to be like Jesus. That's what God is doing in the life of Christians. That's what he wants to do in the life of people who are not yet Christian, that they might come to know Jesus, meet him and be transformed by him. But what was Jesus like? Well, he was the great missionary. He came to seek and save the lost, didn't he? Luke chapter 5, Jesus said, when a whole bunch of religious people challenged him about what he was doing, he said, I haven't come to call the good people. I've come to call the sinners, the broken people. In John chapter 3, he said, the narrator says, Jesus didn't come to condemn the world. He came to save the world. He came as the great missionary. At the end of John's gospel that we looked at over the last couple of months, Jesus said to his disciples, peace be with you. God's peace be with you. As God the Father sent me into the world, I am sending you. Why? To be missionaries, to make Jesus' name known. We were made for mission. Not some of us. All of us. Every person here was made for mission. If you're a Christian and at City Church, yeah, you are unique. Some of you are more unique than others. Each of us is different. Some of you are really different. But no matter the difference, the mission is the same. And the question is, how do you bring your difference to bear on that mission? God has made you different for that mission. That difference, that thing that makes you unique, that thing that makes you tick, the way your passions, the way you communicate, who you like to connect with, those don't rule you out of God's mission. They're exactly what rules you in. Part of it is just working out, how can I be at work in God's mission? Make the mission of making Jesus known your aim. See, without you, the mission won't be the same. The mission won't achieve its aim. You are vital to God's mission. You were made for mission. And I think this is a great thing to measure our church activities against. What should we be doing? Well, if we were made for mission, then we can assess what is it that we should do with our time? What is it we should do together? What is it that we should do in our community groups? What is it we should be doing individually? What is it we should stop doing? What is it that's using up our time that's just a distraction from mission? What is it that will build people up for mission? What is it will help people when they're struggling to grow for that mission? Well, how do you start being on mission? Well, one thinker says, time. Let me read out this quote from him. This is just a starting place for thinking about being made for mission. Time is your most precious gift because you have only a set amount of it. You can make more money, but you can't make more time. When you give someone your time, you are giving them a portion of your life that you'll never get back. Your time is your life. That is why the greatest gift you can give someone is your time. It's not enough to say relationships are important. We must prove it by investing time in them. Words alone are worthless. Jesus said, my children, our love should not be just words and talk. Sorry, it's 1 John. It must be true love, which shows itself in action. He said, relationships take time and effort. And the best way to spell love is T-I-M-E. Well, let me conclude. We were planned for God's pleasure. We were formed for God's family. We were created to be like Christ. We were shaped for serving God. We were made for God's mission. Let me quote Rick Warren. Without God, life has no purpose. Without purpose, life has no meaning. Without meaning, life has no significance or hope.